Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Sound On Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 1 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts.
Last Friday, there was a feeling of, well, stability, maybe, that the worst was over. Then the weekend of Credit Suisse happened. Now Deutsche Bank is in the headlines, and Moody's this week warning that, well, this may not be over. With a risk that banking system stress, says Moody's, could spill over into other sectors, quote, unleashing greater financial and economic damage than anticipated, unquote. So what's going to happen this weekend? I'm not sure I want the answer, but let's bring in Congressman Jake Auchincloss. That's where we begin with the Democrat from Massachusetts, going to talk out a number of issues with us here. Congressman, it's great to have you back. I'm sure you're hearing from constituents about their bank deposits. You're probably hearing from banks in your district as well in Massachusetts. Do you feel like we're through the worst of this?
We're still on the field. Definitely too early to be watching the game film. And a bank run is certainly a time when, as a member of Congress, you realize how many people have your cell phone number. That is no doubt about it.
I believe that.
Not just for sure. And it's not just the startup economy, to be clear, in Massachusetts, which it was a big part of that. It's also affordable housing developers. It's nonprofits focused on early education. Silicon Valley Bank had acquired Boston Private Bank 2 years prior and thereby had a wide swath of the Massachusetts economy. The FDIC and the Fed, they did the right thing, came in strong and clear on that Sunday night to make sure that depositors were whole. But clearly, we are still seeing ripples of panic and repercussions throughout the financial system.
There's been a big question about FDIC insurance. I know hearings haven't even begun on Capitol Hill, and my goodness, this is moving so fast, it's difficult to keep up with unless you're really watching this stuff all day. Janet Yellen made pretty clear yesterday that the Treasury is prepared to backstop deposits, but Congressman, there have been a lot of questions about what the level should be. Should it be unlimited? Should this be through the form of legislation? Do you have an answer?
Shouldn't be unlimited, at least not through congressional statute, obviously, with the exceptions that the Fed and FDIC can make with a supermajority vote. They can do that for systemically important banks. But from congressional statute perspective, we should raise the FDIC limit. I've been clear about that. We should do it through an increased assessment on the banks. It should not be unlimited. What the right number is, we need a number of smart people around the table to help us make that decision.
Something's going to, I suspect, happen here, although you never know with the political climate right now. There's been talk about reinstating portions of Dodd-Frank to make sure that small to mid-sized banks have more intense stress tests. That might be a little bit further out, but it also doesn't seem like Democrats and Republicans agree on deposit insurance either. How come this is so hard?
I think there's different diagnoses of what went wrong here. You see the Republicans retreating to their favorite talking points of, you know, Biden causing this with inflationary spending, whereas Democrats are looking much more carefully at regulators and the job that they could have been doing. And I'm particularly focused on the San Francisco Fed in regards to the Silicon Valley Bank and why their early warning signs were going unheeded and why they didn't feel like they had to raise that up to the next level at the Fed. So it's a challenging issue. It was a challenging issue 15 years ago. It's going to be a challenging issue again. One big concern for me, though, is that we do not let our small and mid-sized regional banks suffer, because what happens after every single bank run is the big banks get bigger because people fly to safety. And the problem there is that the small and medium-sized banks are the ones lending to the home builders and the ones lending to the small companies in this country. They perform a real differentiated service, and we have to make sure that they can continue to bank Main Street.
Mm-hmm. There's been some concern that raising deposit insurance might also encourage more risky behavior. There seem to be a lot of worries about what this might lead to. But the note that I mentioned from Moody's is a bit startling. As soon as you start to think you're getting around this thing, the risk of banking system stress spilling over into other sectors, warning of greater financial and economic damage than anticipated, Congressman, they're already pointing to a possible recession at the end of the year. Should the Fed start cutting rates at this point?
No, and contagion is a bigger concern than moral hazard. I've always been uncompelled by this moral hazard argument that gets made for near-term actions. Is any banker right now looking at Greg Becker and saying, yup, sign me up for that? I mean, the equity shareholders get wiped out. The bondholders get wiped out. Nobody does well when a bank has a run on it, even if the FDIC steps up and makes depositors whole. So this moral hazard argument, maybe in the very long term, you might see indications of it. But in the short run, contagion is the bigger issue here. We cannot threaten a strong economic recovery. And that's what it has been since the nadir of the pandemic 2 years ago with the financial crisis. Because you gentlemen know as well as I do, financial panics, they spread fast, they hurt deep, and they spill over into every other sector of the economy.
What's your biggest concern when you look at the Massachusetts economy? You've got a pronounced biotech corridor there, and as you said, a number of smaller innovators that need that kind of banking assistance to grow.
My biggest concern actually is not to do with the banking sector, it's to do with housing, which obviously is very sensitive to interest rate conditions and to financial services and credit availability. But in my home state, if we don't build the housing that we need to build, and I mean hundreds of thousands of units over the next decade, we're going to asphyxiate our economy because young families can't afford to live here. I mean, the cost of living is crowding out our talent.
Yeah. I've got to ask you about a couple of other things while we have you, of course. The fact that we've seen this meeting overseas between President Xi and President Putin. Xi's back home now. I'm trying to figure out, Congressman, if this was a meeting that kind of moved the needle on this story. We asked John Kirby yesterday if there was any knowledge of an agreement to provide lethal weapons. There apparently is not. How concerned are you about this axis, as some call it, between Russia and China?
There's the old proverb, tell me who you walk with and I'll tell you who you are. And Xi Jinping is telling us all who he is. He is exclaiming his friendship with a internationally wanted war criminal who is marching Ukrainian children out of their homes and into concentration camps in Russia. Whether or not he explicitly agrees to overtly ship weapons, the U.S. intelligence community needs to be monitoring carefully for covert arms sales to Russia through third parties, potentially, because China has a long track record of doing that. And if they do so, it needs to be met with international condemnation and with sanctions. And we also need to step up our response to the crimes against humanity being committed in Xinjiang province against the Uyghur people. Last night, we had a hearing on a China Select Committee where we heard from two survivors about forced sterilizations, rape, internment, slave labor, and really an open-air prison that he has created using a dystopian, techno-driven, Orwellian state that is monitoring people 24/7 inside or outdoors.
I'm sure you're learning things on the Select Committee on China that a lot of Americans don't know about.
Yes, it's eye-opening because, you know, 20 years ago, the United States, and this was bipartisan, decided that we were going to let the Chinese into the World Trade Organization that would put them on a glide path to good global citizenship. And that may have been made with the best of intentions, but 2 decades later, after getting distracted for 20 years and forever wars in the Middle East, we look around and we realize that it didn't work. They are not good global citizens. The CCP is terrorizing its own people. It is increasingly aggressive in the South China Sea, in the Indo-Pacific, in Africa, in Latin America, in our own backyard. And we have got to stand tall and, one, get tougher on the Chinese directly, but, two, and I would argue more importantly, narrate a positive economic vision for the rising countries of the global South about why they want to join in a U.S.-centered, rules-based international order in the 21st century.
I'll ask you lastly, Congressman, I know you need to run, about ending the authorization for the use of military force in Iraq 20 years later. Your colleague Seth Moulton spoke passionately with us about it on the 20th anniversary. I wonder if you see that actually happening in the House.
I do think it'll happen in the House. I think there'll be an unfortunate drop-off in GOP support in the House from the Senate, though. I mean, listen, this thing comes 20 years too late. We should never have fought this war in the first place. The repercussions from it, I think, are difficult, even with two decades of hindsight, to qualify. It cost us moral credibility on the world stage. It damaged U.S. trust in institutions domestically. It has been a disastrous foreign policy decision for us. But we do not have to be weighed down by it perennially going forward. We can make better foreign policy decisions. And under this president, we are seeing that we're doing that in Ukraine, where we are standing for freedom and democracy, where we are supporting a people's right to self-determine against an unjust and unprovoked invasion.
Should we keep that authorization for the war on terror that preceded it following 9/11? Is that a different story?
Potentially more narrowly scoped. The president does need the latitude to strike terrorist outfits with the imminent capability to threaten the United States. That is a legitimate commander-in-chief capability that he needs to have at his disposal. But we do need to review it and, if necessary, more tightly scope it.
I appreciate your spending some time with us, Congressman. Our greetings to Newton, Mass., and I hope you come back soon. Jake Auchincloss, the Democrat from Massachusetts, with us here on the fastest show in politics. Hey, let's assemble the panel. It's Friday. We've got Jeannie Shanzano with us, Bloomberg Politics contributor, joined today by John Sitalides, geopolitical strategist at Trilogy Advisors. John, I'm going to start with you on this because you've spent time advising the State Department, and I wonder your thoughts on the authorization for the use of military force in Iraq 20 years later. Not coming as easily as some thought to end it in Congress, but there are, as I referenced, two authorizations. One followed 9/11. That's for the war on terror. The other came later to precede the war in Iraq. Will Congress do away with this 20 years after the fact, John?
I don't know what the final outcome is going to be here, Joe, but it's certainly going to be a robust debate and one that is long overdue, especially after the precipitous withdrawal from Iraq in 2021. The concern about possible catastrophic terrorism against the United States has not completely abated, but we have done a thorough job dealing with Al-Qaeda, Islamic State, and other major terrorist organizations. But my sense is that many lawmakers are afraid that if they vote to end the authorization, and God forbid there is some type of a terror attack, maybe not against the homeland, but against major U.S. interests abroad, that they're afraid they'll take tremendous heat from their constituents and other influential parties. And so the question is, how do we balance the need to maintain a counterterrorism capability, protect the country and our assets around the world, but also really deal with the much more serious threat, the strategic threat to the United States, both in terms of our security and our global position of leadership, dealing with the Chinese Communist Party and the decades ahead, even while we have this serious problem of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. We have potential Iranian malign activity flourishing in the Middle East, and we still haven't been able to deal with the North Korea nuclear weapons problem. So we're dealing with many problems on a multiple level here, multiple series of levels, Joe, but we have to make sure that we do not lose our sights on the Chinese Communist Party's threats to the United States and the international trading system.
So, Jeannie, is John explaining why it's more likely that that Iraq authorization goes away and the war on terror so-called authorization stays in place?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, the fact is that there is a lot of support for moving forward on the AUMF, but there is a concern because every day we are being told that we are in a potential Cold War, a new Cold War with China, and our government has to have the ability to respond to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see if it happens. There's a chance, by the way, that it doesn't. I mean, it appears that a number of particularly Republicans in the House, John, are not comfortable with doing away with this. They want to have every authorization they can get. Is there a chance this has a 40th anniversary?
I don't know. I don't know. I'd like to say I can look ahead 20 more years, Joe, and I cannot.
That was a totally unfair question. I had to set you up on that.
That's perfectly fine. That's why we're here, to deal with the tough issues.
Yeah.
But I don't know if the authorization will remain in place, but I think it's very important to have this larger debate about where America stands in the war on terrorism, to what extent we can continue to bring in conditions or issues or problems that are not directly related to the counterterrorism war into this orbit, and to misuse this legislation that was specifically enacted to deal with Afghanistan, Iraq, and the threat of radical Islamist terrorism 20 years
Yeah.
ago, and extend it to areas that have nothing to do with those issues. And
John
that's, I think, the
Sedlitis and
concern.
Jeannie Shanzano, we'll finish that thought straight ahead as we stay with the panel. I'm Joe Matthew. This is Bloomberg.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Sound On Podcast. Catch the program live weekdays at 1 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the TuneIn app, Bloomberg.com, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
The banking crisis has, of course, occupied our attention for the balance of the week. Thanks for being with us. I'm Joe Matthew in Washington. Bloomberg Sound On as we reassemble our panel for their take on a lot of the issues and a lot of the questions that need to be answered around this whole thing. We heard Jake Auchincloss, the congressman from Massachusetts, weigh in. Now, Jeannie Shanzano, Bloomberg politics contributor, and John Sidelides, geopolitical strategist at Trilogy Advisors, join us here ahead of what could be, I don't know, another difficult weekend. We were starting to feel, Jeannie, like last Friday. We had some stability here. Then Credit Suisse happened. Now we're looking at Deutsche Bank. We still haven't figured out First Republic, at least at last check. And there could be a name that we haven't even heard yet, as Moody's warns us of greater financial and economic damage if the banking system stress spills over. So it really seems, Jeannie, and you can give me your take on this, that it's really crystallized around FDIC insurance, deposit insurance. And Larry Summers talked to David Westin about that very issue today. You can read about it on the terminal, generating some headlines because nobody can agree on this. Republicans and Democrats disagree, and even within the parties there's disagreement. Summers urging regulators to pledge to back deposits if U.S. banks fail. Here he is.
There needs to be clarity on the situation regarding deposits. Authorities do not have the authority to say that there's going to be some kind of universal guarantee on deposits.
That's important.
What they do have is the essentially equivalent power to declare that in the event of a bank's failure, they will use the systematic risk exemption in order to assure that depositors are paid off in full.
And that's essentially what's happened so far, Jeannie. But do regulators, does Janet Yellen, the president, need to actually articulate it the way Larry Summers just did?
They absolutely do, because it is the lack of clarity that is giving people a real sense of uneasiness. And if they want to head off people saying, you know what, I don't think I can trust this system, I think I need to go make some changes and move to the big banks, they need to assure people of exactly what Larry Summers just said, that we are continuing down this steady road, that we will use the exception and we will pledge to cover deposits. Because the reality is clarity is going to give assurance in these really uncertain times. And that is what the White House and what the administration should be trying to do. Unfortunately, as you've talked about, and we've seen over the last couple of weeks, yeah, particularly Janet Yellen, we have heard multiple statements from almost all sides of these issues. And that makes people feel that the administration isn't in charge of this and isn't leading anywhere except from behind. And that's a problem.
This is technically what Larry Summers is describing, technically not a change in policy. And John, I know you're not a banker, but you are an expert in projecting confidence, whether it's geopolitics or domestic politics. Why doesn't the administration just frame it the way Larry Summers is saying?
I wish I had a precise answer for you there, Joe. I can't read the president's mind or Treasury Secretary Yellen's mind, but here's, I think, the larger concern here. I think they are grappling with several conflicting objectives. One, obviously, is to assure depositors that there is stability and they should have confidence in the banking system. But my concern is that they may be taking directions that are going to have long-term deleterious effects where the exception becomes the rule. And until 10 days ago or 2 weeks ago, depositors up to $250,000 knew their deposits were insured, and above that, they were not. And Treasury Secretary Yellen seems to be indicating that all deposits at whatever level will now be insured, something that the U.S. government simply cannot afford to protect, if we're honest about this. Mm-hmm. And I think also we're seeing what's happening with Deutsche Bank and with banks in other parts of the world that are grappling with U.S. policies that rapidly increased inflation over the last 2 years, and now are rapidly increasing interest rates to try to tame inflation. And so we have distortion in banking investments, in their relationships with their depositors, and there's still significant confusion. This may take weeks, if not months, to fully play out, Joe.
Are you worried, Jeannie, about the weekend ahead?
Yeah, I wish I could say I wasn't, but I think last weekend I was feeling, right when we talked on Friday, oh, things are looking better. Things are steadying.
It's and like a life ago.
Yeah, exactly. And so I feel like I should be a little more cautious this weekend and say I'm not particularly calm. And I would tell you, you know, talking to young people, it has been very interesting to talk to them. They don't remember, for the most part, freshmen in college, you know, what happened in 08.
Right.
Certainly they don't remember the savings and loans crisis, but they do get this wide sense of uneasiness in the financial system, in the markets. They're going to face going out on the job market, interest rates, the cost of everything. They've lived through a pandemic. So, you know, you put all these things in perspective, and we're also talking about confronting China and the autocratic nations of the world. They're starting to feel a little less confident in the United States and our government. And so this is what I think they really need to be focused on in the administrative level, is they need to ensure confidence as much as they can, beginning with the markets this weekend.
Spending time with our panel, Jeannie Shanzano and John Sitalides here on Bloomberg Sound On. Our Friday edition with banking in the air and geopolitics. A lot of us woke up this morning to the headline, or if you're like me, you woke up at 2 in the morning and checked your phone to learn that the U.S. military carried out airstrikes in Syria. This is after an American contractor was killed. 5 of our service members were wounded when a drone of Iranian origin crashed into a coalition base. This is not the kind of headline you want to see, particularly with what's already going on involving China, Russia, Ukraine. And I just wonder what went through your mind, John, beyond the word escalation when you heard this? How concerned are you about Iran and Syria and the potential of adding a new theater?
Significantly concerned, Joe. And what I fear is that, especially in the wake of Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit to Moscow last week and sort of this broadening and deepening of the Chinese-Russian partnership against what we would call the U.S. or Western-led international trading system. Mm-hmm. Iran and Saudi Arabia, of course, are now potentially coming closer as rivals in the Middle East, thanks to Chinese diplomacy announced several weeks ago. And now Saudi Arabia announced it's going to be establishing closer ties with Syria, which is going to be a problem for United States objectives in the area. And Iran is aligned with China, with Russia, against the United States. And it now, I think, senses a weakness on America's part in the Middle East. And I believe that we're going to have a ratcheting up of tensions as Iran feels more emboldened, especially now that it has less to worry about regarding Saudi Arabia, thanks to China's diplomacy.
Did the administration do the right thing by responding with airstrikes, Jeannie?
I think they did. I think they had to respond after the American contractor was killed. I think they tried to keep the damage, certainly as it pertains to human life, to a minimum, and they were able to do that, thank goodness. But they had to respond. But the reality is they wanted to head this off at the pass by exactly what John is talking about, being more engaged in what is going on in the Middle East. And as our attention has turned to China, certainly has turned to what's going on in Ukraine, this administration has not really taken a hands-on approach in the Middle East. And who did? Well, Xi Jinping swept right in there and negotiated this agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And so once again, they are seeming like they are on the world political stage in a way they weren't, say, a decade ago. And the United States is falling off a bit. The Biden administration needs to reassert itself in the Middle East. And this is a clear indication that they have to do that.
You know, it's not something I think most Americans are aware of. That what we heard from General Mark Milley, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in testimony yesterday, just yesterday, said the U.S. now has almost 1,000 troops in Syria, and they are occasionally coming under attack. This was an extreme example of that. But 1,000 troops, John, where's this going?
Yeah, it's very concerning, Joe. It's not only that we have between 900 and 1,000 troops in Syria, but they've been under attack by Iranian proxies on average of once every 10 days. For the last several years.
Wow.
And for the most part, this has been an underreported story. Certainly for the last year, almost all of the media oxygen has been consumed by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And increasingly we see the Chinese threats against Taiwan. And there may be a limit to how much bandwidth is available for both the American people and especially our lawmakers to be able to concentrate on crises, large and small, in so many parts of the world.
1,000 troops in Syria, Jeannie, as we talk about bringing down the authorization for Iraq, what are young people telling you about that? Or are they even aware?
They are aware. And you know, I do think they think the authorization should come down, but they also have, you know, you hear from both sides. On the one hand, they say, why are we so involved in so many places extended around the world when there's problems at home? Mm-hmm. And they have been feeling those intimately. And others who say, we really have to be more engaged in other parts of the world. So there's a big divide. And, you know, that's the political reality that the administration is going to have to deal with, particularly as we march into 24, is answering these types of questions on both sides of the political aisle. And they are real. And of course, most importantly, keeping the United States safe and secure, as well as people from the U.S. who are living abroad, as this contractor was in Syria.
Great conversation with our panel. Jeannie, thank you. Jeannie Shanzano, Bloomberg Politics contributor, and John Sitalides of Trilogy Advisors. We appreciate it as always.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Sound On Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 1 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts.
Some pretty scary headlines coming out of Syria overnight. A lot of folks saw this as they woke up this morning. The military carrying out airstrikes in Syria. After an American contractor was killed, five American service members were wounded when an Iranian drone crashed into a coalition base there. As we discussed last hour with John Sidelides, Kaylee, this is nothing new. They're getting attacked something like every 10 days on average. Mm-hmm. And General Mark Milley, I have to admit, this is not something that I expected to hear, tells Congress in testimony yesterday, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, we have nearly 1,000 American troops on the ground now in Syria. So a lot of questions about what the mission is and where it's heading.
Well, especially because he said those 1,000 troops have occasionally come under attack.
Right.
To your point that this is happening with a certain degree of frequency. And when we have been so domestically focused on a number of issues, the banking crisis capturing all of our attention, a lot of oxygen on Capitol Hill and really just in the public discourse, it is a reminder that we are still involved in many geopolitically tense situations around the world. And Syria coming once again to the fore, of course, after a week that also saw a visit between President Xi and Putin related to Ukraine. I mean, a lot of these geopolitical issues that had been at the forefront of thought seem like they've been put on the back burner. And yet headlines like this force us to pay attention.
Americans only have so much attention to pay, right? I'm really curious to hear what Mark Esper has to think about. And he's kind of joined us, the former Secretary of Defense, with us back on Bloomberg. Mr. Secretary, welcome. It's great to have you back. Your thoughts on this matter in Syria. This is very serious business, and it's not getting an enormous amount of attention. As Kaylee suggested, it's behind Ukraine, it's behind China, it's behind a lot of stories right now. But this has the potential to escalate quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does, Joe. And first of all, great to be back with you again. Look, let me say this much. The threat from Iran and Iranian proxies in the Middle East has been persistent and enduring for some time now. And I know you remarked up front about General Milley saying we have nearly 1,000 troops in Syria. That's unchanged since my tenure as well. Their purpose there is to really support our allies, our partners on the ground, and continue to go after ISIS as it rises up. And then we have some other missions there as well. But needless to say, the Iranians do not like our presence there for any number of reasons. And that's why, as you mentioned up front, we tend to be attacked by Iranian proxies every 10 days to 2 weeks. It's over 70 strikes now since January 2021 is what the military is reporting.
And what is the likelihood or what are the options for de-escalation?
Well, you know, in this part of the world, when you're dealing with an autocracy like Iran, you have to do exactly what we did during my tenure and what the Pentagon did in the last 24 hours. You have to strike back forcefully with resolve, and you have to show them that you're not going to put up with this nonsense. Otherwise, it escalates. And so, of course, DOD is always ready to take these actions. But, you know, this is coming from a regime, Tehran, that has been, causing mischief in the region now for over 40 years. And we are sitting astride one of their major supply routes through Syria into Lebanon to supply Hezbollah and to support other terrorist groups in the region. So, again, they do not like our presence there. And I have every expectation that this will continue as long as this regime remains in power.
Is that why so many think we need to maintain the authorization for the use of military force, not for Iraq, Mark, but for the war on terror, so-called, the one that followed 9/11?
Yes, I don't know if that is the justification that the administration is using, but some may make that point. We do need to have the permission to do that. Congress has been fully aware of this mission for at least since my tenure, at least. Yeah. So we need to have the ability to continue to again, work with our partners on the ground to make sure ISIS doesn't rise up again and threaten us or our partners. But at the same time, have the means to defend ourselves. And that comes naturally under Article 2 of the Constitution. The president can cite that authority for self-protection, self-defense. So we'd have to dig into the particular authorities that they're using, though, to answer that question specifically.
How does Russia factor in here as well? I mean, we were reporting just last week about Vladimir Putin talking with Assad in Moscow.
Yeah, you know, this is the interesting part of the Middle East. It's very complex. So on one hand, we see Russia and Iran cooperating with regard to Ukraine, right? So Iran is providing Shahed 136 drones to Russia to help conduct strikes against Ukrainian civilians in Ukraine. In exchange, Russia now appears to be possibly selling them modern fighter jets. On the other hand, Russia is backing up the Assad regime in Syria, providing support to it. The Assad regime is also a client state of Iran. So here's a place in the Middle East where once again Russia and Iran are cooperating and pushing things against us, our allies, against Israelis, against Turkey as well. So it's a very, you know, complicated situation both in the Middle East and in Europe.
Mark, what are your thoughts? Speaking of complicated situation, of following this 3-day meeting between President Xi and Putin, Xi in Moscow for 3 days, and they talked about their limitless strategic relationship, and obviously great concerns here in the U.S. about the potential for China to be funding essentially Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Although John Kirby told us yesterday that they had no reason to believe there was a deal on providing lethal weapons. Just the optics, though, and the idea that this is happening while this war rages on has upset a lot of people in Washington. What does it mean for our relationship?
Yeah, look, I think this should disabuse anybody of the notion that for some reason Xi Jinping may be moving away from Vladimir Putin in the wake of this strategic failure called the Ukrainian invasion. Just the opposite. His first foreign visit after being given a unprecedented third term as head of the Chinese Communist Party, he goes to Moscow. And that's not unusual because he's made over 30 trips to Moscow now during his tenure. And what we do know is they talked about strengthening their economic cooperation. And look, let's not be fooled. China is supporting Russia right now in this conflict. They're buying their energy. They're providing technical support. They're providing dual use items that Russia can use in the conflict, such as drones. And we're starting to see some evidence that they may have found Chinese munitions on the ground in Ukraine. And look, if it's proven, demonstrated that China is providing lethal military aid to Russia, that will be a game changer in many ways for Russia with regard to the conflict. But probably more importantly, it'll be a game changer strategically with regard to the relationship between the United States and its Western parties and China.
And what would the appropriate response be from the United States, who is also engaged, obviously, in intense back and forth with China over the issue of Taiwan as well? I mean, this just seems like the relationship between these two powerful economic heavyweights is growing more and more tense. I mean, you could also use TikTok as case in point as an example. Just the U.S. and China relationship seems like it is growing more and more fractured.
Well, clearly at this point, I mean, Russia is the junior partner. It's becoming a vassal state, if you will, of China. But just the same, China needs Russian technology, whether it's air defense systems or submarine technology, and certainly energy, because China, as you and your listeners know, is a net energy importer. That said, if it is discovered, learned that China is providing lethal aid to Ukraine, then I think the White House has to deliver on what it said would be serious consequences. In my view, that would be financial and economic sanctions, diplomatic sanctions as well. But the critical part will be getting our European and other Western allies on board to do that. Because if we turn a blind eye or if we are not forceful, all China will do is expand its support to Russia. It will allow Russia to continue the war in Ukraine, and this will drag on for years.
I haven't had a chance to talk since the drone incident over the Black Sea. Now that the Pentagon has declassified the video, we saw the Su-27 dumping fuel and suddenly crashing into this thing. What happens next time we have a close encounter? Mark, does that adjust our policy? And I say that knowing that you endured, and many secretaries have endured, a long history of these close encounter interceptions with Russian aircraft over the years going back to the Cold War.
Yeah, this is not new behavior. This is continued bad behavior. We see it from the Chinese as well in the Indo-Pacific, specifically in the South China Sea area.
Yeah.
And look, I've said that we got to stand up for our rights, our legal right to fly and sail anywhere where it's legal. What they did was not only unprofessional, but really illegal, unlawful. And so I think we should, again, reinstate our surveillance flights. I understand we already have. And if necessary, I've argued we should put a combat air patrol up there. And if Russian aircraft try and approach it once again and and play shenanigans with our drone, then we should be able to move our aircraft into position to defend that drone. Hmm. We can't allow ourselves to be bullied around by the Russians, because otherwise they'll keep doing it. What they want to do is push our surveillance aircraft out of the Black Sea area, because they know we are providing strategic and operational information to the Ukrainians, so mm-hmm. the Ukrainians can prosecute their war against them.
But if you're suggesting that the U.S. become more forceful in a way, when the U.S. has said repeatedly they don't want to escalate anything further, how do you walk that line?
Well, I think you just have to follow your standard procedures, and you have to follow the international law and the protocols that we had set forward. I also believe Russia does not want to escalate. So if for some reason they go up and they see American drone and they think they want to play games with it again, and all of a sudden two American fighters appear, I think they're just going to go away. Mm-hmm. That's been their behavior in the past. They're not going to take us on. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to fight. We shouldn't want to fight either. But we can't, again, allow ourselves to be bullied.
Seeing something similar happen in the South China Sea, of course, with our 7th Fleet, a day after China said that it drove a Navy destroyer away from what they claim were their waters. We're going back in and steaming right through that area. It's that force projection, showing presence more than shooting back, that you're talking about, Mark?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, again, you have to assert your rights. You have to defend your rights. And that's Chinese propaganda that they pushed us out. What we do are freedom of navigation operations. We do them in the South China Sea. We do them in the Persian Gulf. We do them all around the world to assert not just our rights, but global rights to these waters. And China's claims to the South China Sea, it's embodied in their so-called nine-dash line concept, are extraordinarily excessive. So much so that I think the Philippines took them to the international courts a few years ago, and the Philippines won a ruling. But nonetheless, China ignores global rules and norms. This is what we're fighting against. We're fighting against two autocracies that think that they don't have to play by the rules, that they can invade their neighbors, they can threaten their partners or their neighbors like Taiwan or Ukraine and get away with it. And that's not the world we want to live in.
You just said the phrase Chinese propaganda, which brings me to another issue we've all been following very closely over the last, say, 48 hours here in Washington, when TikTok CEO was on Capitol Hill getting absolutely grilled by a bipartisan committee in Congress, all of which, pretty much all of the members, expressing concern about the risk TikTok poses to national security. Can you just give us your assessment as a former defense secretary of what exactly that risk looks like and how significant it would be for China to have access to the kind of data on that we are understood they have on 150 million Americans or could access?
Sure. You know, first of all, I've only caught snippets of the hearing. I'm actually dialing in from Lithuania. I keynoted a Baltic military conference here, and I've been meeting with our allies and the prime minister and others to talk about
wisely,
Ukraine and Russia. Yeah. So look, first of all, with any social media site, you're surrendering a degree of privacy. People will know what you're doing and be able to kind of know you better than you know you, so to speak. The concerns, again, of course, with TikTok, which has well over 100 million users in the United States, is can they somehow aggregate that data? Can it be used either against you if you are somehow in a position of power, or can they aggregate it to either understand what's happening in America, or can they send certain messages, either pro-China messages or, let's say, anti-NATO messages using the TikTok network? And one thing that we're very concerned about, of course, is any Chinese company is bound under Chinese law to surrender data, any other type of information, or be subject to the rule of law in China as it exists. It's a police state. And so there are a lot of concerns about Chinese governance, about how the Chinese very cleverly and strategically use data. And I think it is of utmost concern to, obviously, lawmakers. And, importantly, a few weeks ago, there was a hearing on Capitol Hill where the director of national intelligence, the director of the NSA and others spoke about this. And I really trusted their views on this. And each of them expressed concerns, to include the FBI director, Chris Wray, about TikTok and how data collected by TikTok and then used, aggregated, could be used against America.
We'll see if it ends up being banned. Mark, congratulations, by the way. Not only are you in Lithuania, I'm looking at the Lithuanian embassy here on Twitter with great photos of you receiving a state award from the president himself for your contribution to regional security. So I know you're being celebrated over there, and we salute you from the other side of the ocean.
Well, thank you very much. It's look, these are great allies over here. And here's a country, Lithuania, that just got out underneath Soviet subjugation a little over 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And they see very clear-eyed what's coming out of Moscow and are very concerned about what's happening in Ukraine. There's a very different view in Europe about the threat, or at least in certain parts of Europe, than there is in parts of the United States.
I believe that. Get home safe. Mark Esper, former Secretary of Defense, with us here on Bloomberg. I'm Joe Matthew with Kaylee Lyons on Sound On. This is Bloomberg. Thanks for listening to the Sound On podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at Bloomberg.com.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.